The views and opinions expressed here are those of the guests, and are not the official position of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
One of the most remarkable aspects of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. According to information found on LDS.org, materials for the church are currently available in 166 languages. Of course, not every item or broadcast is available in every language, but we have with us in the Mormon Channel studio today people who have helped make this happen over the years. We have quite a crowd, and we'll just go around and have each of them introduce themselves. Let's start with Joe Stringham.
I've been working since 1973 in the translation division of the church, and it's been fun years, really fun years.
I'm Jeff Bates, and I'm the director of translation. I've been involved in this work for the last 20 years.
I'm Hiroko Mitarai. I started working for the church in 1975. I started working for the translation in 1981.
My name is Deanna Tucker. I started in working for the translation department, I guess the year that it was formally organized in 1966. Initially, I started with the helping Eduardo Valderas, who was one of the pillars of the translation department in the Spanish division. Later on, I was given the responsibility of the Liahona magazine, which I continue to do up to this day, among other tasks.
I'm Rodney Frateau. I began working in translation in May of 1969. My first interpretation experience was General Conference of October 1968, after the first stake in Tonga was organized.
My name is Todd Harris. I currently manage scripture translation for the church, and I'm just starting my 24th year in the translation division.
I'm Jeff Johnson, and I'm the young one here in the group. I started in 1992, so I've had 19 years with translation, and I'm currently working with the interpretation section.
Thank you. Thank you all. I'm not great with numbers, but it sounds like we have a lot of years of experience and a lot of service for the church in the area of translation. Let's just begin by trying to determine just how many languages. I said 166 from the church's website, but that doesn't really tell us exactly, like, how many languages the Book of Mormon have been translated in, how many are done at conference each time. Let's just kind of talk about how many languages each and every day we're dealing with in the church. Who wants to start with that? Jeff.
We deal right now actively in about 105 languages. Not everything, as you mentioned, is translated in all those languages, but there are items that are being translated or worked on or interpreted in 105 actively now.
As far as General Conference goes, we're doing 92 languages for General Conference interpretation.
What are some of the newer languages, shall we say, that have been added most recently?
Tzotzil, which is a language spoken in Central America, Guatemala, and Malay. Those would probably be the most recent.
Todd, how about the Book of Mormon? How many languages do we have in that so far?
Officially, the Book of Mormon has been translated all or part into 107 languages.
And most recently, what would be?
The most recent translation we published was Guarani, which is an indigenous language in Paraguay, in South America. And we're writing right now a new translation in Lao and a translation in Quechua, Bolivia, Quechua, Ecuador, one of the indigenous languages in Ecuador.
Very, very good. Let's talk about, this is a show called Legacy. We deal with church history. Let's talk about how translation in the church got started. A lot of fingers are being pointed in the studio right now.
I can point at Rodney very easy.
And our listeners can't see fingers pointing. But anyway, let's determine who's going to talk and go for it.
Rodney and Deanna both were here during the Richard Street era. I'd like to hear a little bit about that myself.
While they're collecting their thoughts, let's have Todd just talk a little bit about what happened back in the Joseph Smith era.
That's a great idea.
When you talk about translation, really, then start with the origins of the church. Joseph Smith's first task was to translate the Book of Mormon from the plates into English, and he began work on that. He finally received the plates in 1827, and so that could be counted as the starting point of translation. He worked off and on by himself or with Emma until early spring of 1828, when he started then with Martin Harris. Martin and Joseph worked until June of 1828. Then there was a break, as we know from church history, and then Oliver Cowdery and Joseph Smith began working again together in spring of 1829. The book was first, the translation was finished then in June or July of 1829, went to typesetting initially in August of 1829, and came off the presses in March of 1830, and that was the start of translation in the church.
The first translation was English.
First translation was into English from the original languages on the plates.
Very good. What was the second?
Danish was next in 1851.
Wow, okay.
Followed in quick succession by French, Welsh, Italian, and German. And those were done under the direction of either Lorenzo Snow or John Taylor in the respective countries.
Very good. So, modern translation. Let's leap forward a little bit and talk about how things sort of got started with so many languages.
Deanna was hired, and she worked as a secretary for Eduardo Balderas.
Eduardo Balderas was a name that resonated with a lot of the first converts to the church, whether in Mexico, Latin America. He was instrumental in the translation of the hymn book, the first hymn book, and a lot of the standard works. I just happened in 1966 to be reading a church news, and on the cover was a picture of Brother Balderas and Thomas Fiennes, who was the first director of the translation department. I was hired by Brother Balderas as a secretary at that time to help in transcribing the patriarchal blessings that he would give to the saints in different branches at that time. Subsequently, I learned a little bit more of the English language and was given the responsibility to translate what was then the Relief Society magazine. After that came the Liahona magazine, which was the model for the magazines that came afterwards in the other different languages. By 1977, the church was publishing the Liahona in 37 languages, which at that time was called the Unified Magazine. And but the Liahona in Spanish was the official publication of the church back then.
Very good. It hasn't been that long ago that Spanish has become the most spoken language of the church. Is that true?
Exactly.
Very good.
Exactly.
With the Liahona, is that also, 105 languages, is that about close for the Liahona magazine?
No, I think the Liahona magazine is published right now in about 50,
okay.
50 languages.
All right. Very good. Mm-hmm. How does one or the department determine what language will be next as part of church translation?
That process is determined by request from area presidencies, and those requests are forwarded to the first presidency. So it's a decision of the brethren whether or not we will begin translating into one language or another. And they have a step-by-step process for how that's done. There are four levels, an introductory level, and then a phase one, phase two, and phase three set of materials that are to be translated. So when a request comes in, normally the area presidency will say, we'd like to begin translating in this language, and we recommend that approval be given for the introductory phase materials. And those are very, very limited. The Joseph Smith testimony pamphlet is translated. And what else, Todd?
Gospel fundamentals is
part of that. Then in phase one, when they move from introductory to phase one, that's when they begin the translation of the scriptures and some other materials.
I recall from my years in video editing that some of the videos in phase one, we used to call phase one videos, included the first vision and restoration of the church, as I recall, or others. But it's nice to actually bring that together for my mind. Thank you. So tell me, how has technology helped or hindered in what has transpired in translation?
Deanna, you're laughing. You remember the old Adler typewriters,
right.
I think, don't you?
Right.
Yeah.
When we had to send the... excuse me. Go ahead.
When I started working, we didn't have a typewriter in Japanese. And so I actually had a calligrapher. She had a much better handwriting than I did. And so I had her write the translation. And so that's how we started. Now, and then, too, when the electric typewriter came up, you know, when we translated into English from Japanese, then we did not have a collectible tape. And when collectible tape came up, I thought, oh, what a marvelous invention. That's what I thought.
Correctable tape. Yes, we've moved on into the 20th century. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I wasn't a translator then. I was in support. And I really remember clearly when we got the IBM Ball Selectric typewriters and how wonderful they were. And I thought, well, I'm not going to get one as one of the first people, but I'll probably get one. There'll be something that will cascade down to me eventually. It never happened. All these IBM Ball typewriters were provided for translators and people that were using them all the time. And then we went from the IBM Ball typewriter into the word processors. And I missed out on the IBM Ball typewriter altogether.
Of course, we moved from the first word processors then into desktop computers. And most of the translation is done now by translators in their country on their own computer. And this has been a marvelous change for us. What has happened, particularly in the last 5 or 10 years now, is the introduction of Unicode. And with Unicode, you can now get all of the different character sets for all of the different languages of the world, something that was never possible for us before. When you think of Hiroko's comment about having to have a calligrapher write the Japanese characters for her, now an individual translator can type in their own language using the proper character set.
Can you tell me about the history of having translation done all here and then sending it back to country? How did that come about? What was the impetus? What was the reasoning?
Well, I think that we've had it go back and forth a couple of times. It's one of those things that sort of cycles depending upon certain times. We had area offices for a while, but in the real beginning, we had them just here. People like Rodney did Tongan here. Samoan was done here. And then we moved it to the areas. And then after about 8 years or so, we moved it back here. and circumstances then changed, and we were allowed to be able to move it back to the areas again. And right now, I think it's in the areas, and will probably stay in the areas for the duration of all of translation. It seems like we've got the talent, and we've got the energy out there in the field to be able to do all the translations now on location.
I recall that before translation sections and translation services and groups were set up, each mission, as they were organized, began having their own translation. Scriptures were not available, so certain passages were translated in order to have maybe a Book of Mormon study in Sunday school or priesthood. The Bible translation is taken care of by the Bible Society, with the exception of Spanish when they came out, and Deanna can probably respond to that, and Todd with the Bible Project in Spanish. Our particular Bible in Tongan was published in 1884. And I marvel at the early translators, how they came up with terminology. They created words. They combined words to make different meanings. Back then, many things seemed foreign to everyone. But right now, when you mention a word, it's just secondhand to all of these languages. And so that happened throughout the world, I believe. And then I believe it was in 66 when Bishop Brown started to go around various countries. And I don't recall the number of languages that they started with. It was called Established Languages. And they first established the translation offices in the language area. And they usually had a staff of five or six. Everything, again, started with either a tape recorder or writing it by pencil. Secretaries would type those, as Joe has mentioned, evolving into various areas. And then a time it came to Salt Lake, and as Joe has stated, back and forth. And there have been many individuals who have been involved in translation, making our job much easier today. And as others around this table have commented on electronic translation, I suppose in the number of years I've been in translation, the greatest help to me as a translator is memory programs. I recall the number of various translation that was done. No success can compensate for failure in the home. Think of how that can be said many different ways in English. And so I would translate it one way. The other person didn't know I had translated it before, so they translated it a different way, all meaning the same but just different. So the memory program in the translation aids that we now have is really a great aid to translators.
Can someone describe the memory program to me, since I'm a little clueless on that?
What happened was, back then, they had computers, and they were starting to try and do machine translation, not very successfully. But we did have computers that we were using for the translations, where you could use the computer as a standard text and make the corrections on it without having to write the whole thing over, which is what we had to do on the Adler typewriters. And at that time, this was 1974, I noticed I was doing a pre-read for the translators called adaptation. And we would look for texts in there that were already translated in a new manual or something. And we would try and mark where that had been translated before so we didn't have to translate it again. And we called it the quote index. And I remember when we tried to start it out, we had to keep it under wraps because we had to use the Xerox machine, which was new. And every time you used the Xerox machine, you had to write down the number of sheets of paper that you used and what you used them for. And the quote index was just a form that was used to write in at the quotes that we ran into previously with all the information on them. And nobody thought it was worth putting on paper. And after about a year of recording that, I got a manual. It was a priesthood manual, PCMP 60E6. This was the first one that we did. And I used that quote index, and I found all these quotes and put the information in there for the translators who'd be doing the book. And I turned it into my supervisor. And my supervisor came back and he says, "Where did you get all this information? Where did you find this?" And I says, "Oh, I just had it in my mind." And of course, you know, they finally pried it out of me that I had this index, and it was pretty primitive. There were so many people after that that blessed our situation by being able to put it on computer and make it so it was far more efficient. But we found that 11% of a text was pre-translated somewhere else, and all we needed to do was find it and reuse it. And it saved a lot of cost.
So moving from that phase, where Joe was basically doing that manually and keeping track of that, we're now into an era where technology allows us to do that much quicker and more efficiently. Computers now can store large databases of information, of previously translated information. And so when we're ready to translate a manual, we can run the process in the computer to check for previously translated passages. And the computer will do that lightning fast and can retrieve back specific phrases that are in our new text that were translated in a previous one and literally pre-populate them into our computer screen so that we just have to look at it and verify, yes, that's what we want, accept it, and move on with the rest of the translation.
So by now you're probably a little above 11% on matching. Is that true?
Probably we are.
Well, and whether for a given document it may be 11% or others 20 or only 4, but we can mine from this translation memory whatever is available to help us. They refer to that as leveraging translation memory, and it's been a great boon to the church.
Wow. The thing about it, too, is that I had no vision beyond being able to put it on paper. And there were other people that had the vision of being able to put it in an electronic format. And I think someone starts out and does something, but then someone can always improve on what we've done. And that's what we've seen throughout our history in the department.
So when we're talking about translation outside of church headquarters, it's mostly materials versus live translation for, like, in a general conference broadcast. Is that accurate?
Interpretation.
Okay,
interpretation,
so let's talk about that for just a moment, please. I've run into this in my time with church employment. I say the translators are here, and, well, they're not translators. This time they're interpreters. So please enlighten me on the difference.
Rodney, you were here at the beginning. Tell us about the early days.
Well, the early days, I suppose, when we first started, and it was Joe and others, I could remember idiomatic expression that we did not understand, translating wallflower. There's more than one way to skin a cat. And they were translated literally, and no one in the foreign languages understood what in the world was there's more than one way. And one manager caught this in a translation. So we went back to the translator, and he says, there's more than one way to skin a cat. So you begin from the tail is one way. You begin from the head is one way. And so then, with the assistance of people like Joe and others, explaining to us what those phrases mean. And so in Just very early days in doing translation, it was difficult. And as Joe says, it has gone back and forth. The idea was the best translation can be done in the language area because they speak the language daily. But then we realized that one also has to understand the source language very well. Otherwise, we may translate it in a different way. So at the beginning, people were using translation, interpretation, randomly, with really not knowing which is which. And my understanding is that interpretation is what is done verbally, and translation is what's put down into words. When we first began translation, they were very interpretation. They were very, very fast speakers. For instance, LeGrand Richards was one of them, and I believe that by the time he passed away, even though this was a time when scripts were being provided, he didn't provide one. But in those days, we were not given a text beforehand. Now we do. And we used to do our own translation and then read those translation as interpretation during the general conference. Now, translation is being done in a local area, and if interpretation is done here in a conference center, those translations are forwarded to the interpreters, and they would read those. Even though we may have that once in a while, especially at the beginning of a talk, the brethren may refer to a talk that was just given. So we have to watch that so we don't start reading the text of his talk before hearing what he's beginning with. And so now it's still very, very difficult, but it's much easier than in 68 when my father and I first started doing interpretation in Tongan.
I think English is the only language where you can skate on thin ice and end up in hot water. What was those early conditions that you interpreted under like? You were in the basement of the tabernacle. Was it over in the assembly hall?
I started afterwards. The one that I recall that was over there, I'm sure Brother Balderas was involved with it, was Edna Alba. And she had the experience of working in the, underneath the assembly hall. We did not start until it moved. Of course, there were times when interpretation was done right in the tabernacle, to where interpreters would either sit behind the leader that was not did not understand English, or besides them. And as the talks were given, proceedings of conference were being done, sustaining of officers and other things, an individual would whisper. And sometimes that can be quite disturbing for those who are trying to listen that do not understand the interpretation. So we went through that, and finally, there was a place provided underneath the tabernacle, the horseshoe area that's referred to. I think now it's being set up for the tabernacle choir. But it was dirt floors covered with carpet. With when we first began, they were just these fold-out long chairs, tables, and then with little dividers, and then with a microphone, no text. And those were very, very trying years in trying to do interpretation. And then the booths were set up, and the floors were concreted and nicely carpeted. And now we're in a conference center, state-of-the-art, really nice facilities over there. And so I think we're spoiled a little bit nowadays with the facilities that we now have available to us to do interpretation. But very, very trying when you try to interpret simultaneously without a text.
You had to have nerves of steel at that time for, like he says, just a little bit of humor. When the general authorities would sometimes start with a joke, it was sometimes so difficult to be able to convey the meaning of what it was trying to be transmitted, that where we call at one time an interpreter was left blank. He didn't know how to translate the joke. So the people listening on the, in the tabernacle were told, the general authority just said a joke, start laughing.
That's all you can do sometimes.
That's right. I heard the same story, but then I have to tell you my personal experience. That is, this was in the Tabernacle Horseshoe. And nowadays, we have more or less a rather strict guideline for women to be interpreting for a women speaker and the men to be interpreting for a men speaker. But then when I started, it wasn't really that strict. So I was throwing for the first time. I was a BYU student then. I was even working for the church. But anyway, so I had the script. I translated it myself, and then I was already, I thought. But then this person, nowadays we have two people in the booth, just in case something happens, then the other person can pick it up right then. But they left me all by myself for the first time, and then the announcer said something like, this is the 142nd Annual General Conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And then I just froze. Completely froze, and I couldn't say a word.
I remember when we started getting scripts. Basically, I remember President McKay wanted to move to a scripted conference because we had television coverage, and they had to break at certain points for station identification. And so because the general authorities were writing their text, we started translating the texts and getting them ahead of time. And that was a big boon. But that didn't prevent these general authorities from injecting spontaneous comments, and some of them, Elderly Grand Richards, David Haight. Elder Haight would never use a text because he didn't have any sight to be able to read it in there from the pulpit. So these spontaneous or extemporaneous speakers were still a big challenge for everybody.
I think we should perhaps mention, it's been mentioned before, but then what's unique about translation processes is that adaptation. Now, I know Todd used to be the manager of adaptation, and then perhaps I think we should mention something about adaptation.
When a text comes in English, as we've talked about, there are sometimes expressions and sometimes information that is difficult for the translator either to understand or to find. And so we started a section in the church where we would adapt the English talk or the material for the translator. And that meant that a native English speaker would go through and note all the places where there might be difficulty for a translator either to understand or to access information. And we would prepare notes that would explain either the figure of speech or provide the information where that citation could be located. And we did that for conference talks. We would do it for manuals. We do it for all the material that the church translates, so that every translator has a consistent note as far as explaining something so they can understand that. And so things are translated the same way across the languages. And
that is done for each talk or?
It's done for all the material that the church translates. And this is an area that's unique in the church. I've gone to conferences and visited other places where translation is done. And many times another company, for example, will just provide a document that needs to be translated to a translator. And it's up to the translator himself or herself to do all the research and to find out what the background material is and means and so on. And that leads sometimes to translations which vary radically in quality. But we've managed to produce translations in the church which are of high quality and of consistent high quality because we go ahead and prepare or adapt the talks and all the material ahead of time so that all translators get the same kind of information, which helps them then provide consistent and correct translations.
There's a point here I'd like to mention in connection with that that has to do with the advances in technology. One of the greatest things that ever happened to us was the advent of email. It used to be we had to wait a long time for material to get to and from a translator between the translator and church headquarters. But with email now, we can send things out and receive them almost instantly. And so the kinds of adaptation that Todd has talked about, the translator notes that are prepared, can be sent to translators all over the world, and they can do their work on that. If during the course of their translation, as sometimes happens for conference talks, the speaker chooses to make a revision to the talk that he's preparing, and they will send that revision to us in the translation department, again, we can email that revision out to the translators so they have access to it and can work on it. So that's been a great blessing.
As Todd was commenting on what kinds of things we adapted or what kinds of things we made notes on, I remember one quote of Joseph Smith. He said, teaching the members of a church a new principle is like splitting a log with a corn dodger for a wedge and a beetle for a hammer. And I still remember how we had to try and work that out. How are we going to translate this? How are we going to make that so that it makes sense? So there were a lot of real challenges with that.
Another one of the challenges in that area is the dating that goes, you know, in with young people. It's the rules or standards are very different from what is done here in the United States and in other cultures. And that always presents some kind of challenge that needs to be adapted to the circumstances.
And it's something that is talked about a lot, and so it must be addressed on almost constant basis.
I think it's, if I may just make a comment, sometimes it's underestimated what Todd and Joe and Brother Johnson have explained about making translation notes, helping us interpreters understand something, or as translators. One of the most difficult things, think of yourself as an interpreter without text, and someone tells a story about football, American football. And I think most of us here know the importance of the quarterback. I don't know of any other sport. All the other sports is a team effort. In American football, you have the quarterback calling the plays and so forth. And try to fit that into the meaning that the speaker is using that for. I remember a talk that had to do with the candy, something about divinity, and changing that into divine. And it doesn't work in any language because divinity, candy, doesn't come out the same translation as being divine. And so these are areas that we struggle through in making those translation. And the translation notes or adaptation that is done by the group of native English speakers help us understand what other alternatives that we can use. And it may be just a slight twisting, not going into football so much, but just discussing the principle.
One of the things that we've had to focus on in the audiovisual department over the years is trying to make products less American-like and internationalize things a little better for this very reason, to try to make them a little better understandable in different cultures. So,
in talking about audiovisual, there was a film that was made, and during those days we did what was called, still being done now, lip synchronization, trying to match the lip movement and the sound of our interpretation to match the movement of the lips in the original film. So we were given a film to work on. It was a motivational type film, and we affectionately call it the chicken or the rooster film. And talking about being chicken and trying to make that happen, and so eventually it was just scrapped in all the languages because the chicken and what it means to be chicken, afraid to do something, just doesn't work in any other culture. It only worked in, I think, all English-speaking areas. I'm not sure. Maybe just the U.S.
Interesting. Does anyone else have
an inspirational or rewarding type of experience you'd like to share with our audience?
Pride sometimes is an interpreter's worst enemy. I recall in the days when we did not have scripts, and I suppose my father and I maybe didn't do as good a job as we should have, and an individual came and volunteered his help to assist us. And so he began interpreting, and finally someone from the Spanish section came over and says, "There's no one in your booth." And so we went over there and continued interpreting. And we saw the young man afterwards and says, "What happened?" And I said, and he said, "I thought it was so easy. I sat down. I couldn't think of a thing to say, even the easiest sentences." And myself and others do a lot of preparation beforehand when we are given a text. And I recall in section 9 where the Lord says to Oliver, "You took no thought save it was to ask me." In other words, just sitting down and expect the Lord to give you everything that you need. I believe personally that we do all the preparation that we can using the materials that has been mentioned. And after we do that, if we are lacking in some area, the insertion of thoughts that the speaker thought needed to be made there is taken into account, and it's handled through our interpretation. There are times when the Lord wants us to do something. The brother of Jared, the Lord says, "What would you have me do?" when they were about to sail in darkness and so forth. The Spirit is very, very important. I remember one time I was doing an interpretation, really feeling good about myself, and I said, "Boy, I'm really doing well." Joe does a good job of teaching us tools on how to do our interpretation and think of several other things at the same time. So I'm reading the interpretation that I had prepared, and in my mind I think, "Boy, I'm really doing great," and I think everyone thinks I'm great, and then I just went blank. I couldn't read my text anymore. So spirit is something that we don't talk a lot about, but a lot of times that is what helps us over the difficult areas of a talk. Elder Scott gave a talk discussing scientific things, and maybe the scientific thing in our language is just lighting a match. And then when he talks about nuclear things, we have no words for it. And so those are the times where the Spirit interacts and assists us on what to say, whether it's direction from Elder Scott on how to do certain things or giving us an idea that we didn't think of. And so it's relying on the Spirit after we have done all that we can do is always a big part of interpretation and translation.
I'd like to tell one spiritual experience, I think, that's appropriate to tell. Back in the mid-80s, we had a program called the All Nations Program, where we were trying to have at least one language that was spoken in every country of the world. And we had Djibouti, which had the language Afar. And my assignment was to go anywhere in the United States if I could find someone who could translate into Afar for us. We would translate some basic materials, the Gospel Principles Manual and Joseph Smith History. And I finally chased down, going back and forth from East Coast to West Coast, I found that there was a man on the East Coast who was a minister that could probably lead me to someone that could speak Afar. And I called him on the phone and made arrangements to go visit him in Washington, D.C. And I found out that he was a minister in the Ethiopian Evangelical Church. And I thought to myself, "Oh, no, an evangelical, and I'm a Mormon. This is going to be two cats in a bag." And I got there. This was, mid-1984, 85. and went in to visit this fellow in his office, sat down, and he looked at me, and he said, "You're a Mormon." He says, "I don't like Mormons and their doctrine." He says, "I wouldn't want to touch anything that a Mormon had written or anything of that sort." He says, "But you, your church held a fast for the people of Ethiopia, and you collected enough money of your members to be able to drill wells and relieve some of that suffering that was going on in my country." And he just looked down, then he looked up at me, he says, "I'll do anything I can for you. I'll do anything I can." And he did. He found a person that could speak. His name was Hanfari Aligas. And I still remember that minister, great man, very humble man, and his willingness to help. And it was partially due to all the members of the church and their fast. And I was indirectly a beneficiary of all the members in that fast. And I was very thankful.
Thank you. Any other thoughts or comments today?
I just would like to mention that I do agree with what has been said by Rodney the importance of the work of translation. I remember on one occasion I was talking with one of my superiors, manager, and about the work of translation, and I told him about how I felt about translating for the magazine. There have been many times when I have been moved to tears in reading a text that I'm about to translate. And I told him at that time that I felt that my responsibility in my translation, or that I would felt that I would have accomplished my purpose if the person that would read my translation would also be moved to tears. And I think if we can convey that type of feeling in our translations with the help of the Lord, that will be a wonderful thing. There is a section in the Liahona magazine that is sort of like the letters to the editor, and is entitled Comments. Whenever I have translated one of those short paragraphs from a member in Latin America that has been inspired, that has had a life-changing experience because of something that he read in the magazine, sometimes I am at awe when they mention a specific article that I have read maybe 5 or 6 times, either in the process of translation or reviewing or proofreading, and it has not touched me that way, and then it has made such an impact in the life of a person, then I know that it comes from the Lord, that the work that we are doing, it is tremendously important.
I'd like to share one
sure.
experience that was particularly moving for me. In the early 90s, I was involved in scripture translation, and we were working on a particular language with a sister who had been chosen to be the translator. And I was helping her review some of the translation she'd done and was asking her some standard questions that we ask about different verses. And we happened to be in Mosiah chapter 13, and we came to the story of Abinadi in the court of King Noah. And in the third verse there, Abinadi tells Noah's priests to touch him not, because he hasn't yet completed delivering the message that he was sent to deliver. and that they would not be able to destroy him until he had done so. And I asked a question about that verse, which was in our standard set of quality assurance questions at the time, that says, does this translation flow smoothly, and would one be able to commit it to memory easily? And the translator said, as she read it back out loud, and said, yes, I think it would, but why would anyone want to memorize this verse? And I said, well, it's an important verse. It teaches us the principle that when one is on the Lord's errand, then there is nothing that can prevent that person from accomplishing that task if they are worthy and dedicated to it. And she paused and looked at me, and then she said, would that apply to me? And as she did, the emotions welled up in me so strong as I turned to her and said, oh, yes, sister, oh, yes. And then the two of us sat together and wept as the Spirit bore witness to us that she was indeed on the errand of the Lord.
I would just say, you know, translation is a gift of the Spirit. And it's so important that we have the Spirit as we do our work. There are so many people who come to the event, come to the desk or the computer with their five loaves and two fishes, so to speak, of offering up to the Lord whatever skill and talent and ability that He's given them, and then relying on the Spirit to do whatever they can to help build the kingdom for the benefit of the people in their language. There's really a Spirit in this work, and one of the greatest challenges I think a translator has is to be in tune with the Spirit so that they can do this work. It's probably the one thing that differentiates us from the world of translation and the industry of translation, is that we're working with what's been called the crown jewels of the church, the doctrine of the church, the scriptures, the words of the living prophets. And so we're very cognizant of that and desirous always to keep ourselves in tune so that we can put forth the word of the Lord as He would have it. It's always interesting, and when you talk about what are some of the spiritual experiences people have had, many of these are so sacred to these people. And over the years, I've made attempts to try to collect experiences of translators, interpreters, in what they do. And I've not been successful because they are so sacred to the people that they don't talk about it a lot. It's always gratifying to see an interpreter come out of the booth with tears streaming down his eyes or her eyes after interpreting a talk, knowing that they had the Spirit with them, knowing that they were magnified beyond their abilities to do what they needed to do. And there are just such great occasions that happen in the life of every translator in the church who puts their life in order and does the work.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you all for being here, for your thoughts, your expertise, your Spirit, sharing the history and current things to do with translation and interpretation in the church, getting the message of the restored gospel throughout the earth. Thank you, one and all.